Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Colorism is not a new word. It's been bandied about, at the very least, since activist Alice Walker referred to it in an essay decades ago. But it is a word which has flown under the radar when it comes to national conversation. Flying so low, it hasn't yet won an official dictionary definition. And yet, colorism represents a real and painful form of discrimination. It's loosely defined as prejudice between people of the same race based on skin color. And in general, the darker the tone, the greater the discrimination. Lori Tharps tackles this complicated subject in her new book, Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. Tharps is an associate professor of journalism at Temple University, and she joins us as our guest this hour of Radio Times. Welcome back, Lori.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So in your book, you write that colorism is a private agony that influences identity formation, self-esteem, and personal relationships. Let's begin with a bit of your own history. As you write, you are a Black American woman with a medium brown skin. Your husband is Spanish, but his pale skin warms up to a nice shade of brown in the sun, as you put it. So you know, when you began to have children, did you have expectations when it came to skin tone?
Absolutely. My husband and I, as most expectant parents do, we spent a lot of time imagining what our child would look like. And even though my husband is he's pale. He is from the south of Spain. He has relatives who are much darker than him, and he himself tans very, very easily. He is pale, but he doesn't have that kind of skin that burns right away and he only gets red. And so we just assumed that our children would be brownish. They would be on the browner side of the spectrum. And we assumed that their hair would probably be very curly because I have black kinky hair and he has very curly hair. So we did think about it, but we didn't think about it in any way that would seem, you know, that it would be an odd, that the child would look very different from either one of us or even different than what our, you know, extended family members looked like. But and our first child, when he was born, he was very, very pale and he had very straight hair. And for a long time, when I was out with him, people assumed I was his nanny.
The comments started coming almost immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when something like that happens, what is your reaction? What are you thinking?
Well, it's really jarring. I think first-time parents are always surprised by the whole experience of parenting. And you're prepared for the, you know, lack of sleep, diaper changes, and the complete change that your life is going to go through when you have a child. But I don't think you can ever be prepared for what it's like to have a child, you know, come out of your body and be assaulted with this constant public scrutiny of the relationship, where people are constantly asking you, what is the relationship between you and that child? I think most people expect to hear, oh, he looks just like you, or he looks like his father, or, you know, what a cute baby, you know, just kind of benign comments that a public would give you, as opposed to public comments of, are you the nanny? Whose baby is that? Where did you adopt that child from?
And it was constant, you said.
It was very constant. I lived in New York at the time when my first child was born, and there is a very strong kind of nanny culture where you have black women caring for white babies. Mm-hmm. So I just looked like one of any other kind of black caretaker for white child. And it was so jarring that I actually, you know, ended up spending a lot of time thinking about nanny culture and ended up writing a novel about it, because it had become so much a part of my mothering experience. And then, of course, that was even challenged more when my second child was born. I had another son who my elder son ended up browning up at about age two, and his skin did get darker. His hair got curlier to the point of loose kinks. And then my second son was born, who looked just like his brother at birth, very light skin and straight hair, but his skin never darkened. So then I was a mother of two children, one who looked dark and one who looked light. And people, the comments doubled because it was now, oh, look at that, a black child and a white child, one mother. Wait, who belongs to who? And then my husband, who was pale, if he was with my elder son, who was darker, it became, is that your adopted child? Where did you get him from? You know, all those kind of, I don't understand how you two are connected. If I was with my my younger son, it was, are you the nanny? If my husband's with the elder son, it was, where did you adopt him from? Or any number of confused looks and questions about the connectivity of relationship.
And so before you started having children, you were not prepared for any of this?
Not at all. I actually just heard Zadie Smith on talk about this in her new book, mm-hmm. Swing Time, and her own experience that all mothers, you know, when you think about your child, even if you having an interracial relationship, we all assume our children will look like us. There's just really nothing in our preparation to think that our child is going to look so different from us that the connection will be questioned by the public. And even knowing that your husband is lighter than you or darker than you, you still assume your child will look something like you, that there will be something recognizable in their features. And skin color is, of course, one of those things. I never assumed my child would come out, any of my children would come out so much lighter than me that people would question our relationship.
And your daughter, Aida, is also on the lighter side.
Yes, my daughter is very pale and her hair is... For the first 2 years of her life, her hair was very straight. I actually was asked if I had adopted my daughter from China, which that definitely takes the case of like of the most bizarre question I had ever been asked. But again, it was still shocking to me because you just aren't prepared for that much difference in visual appearance of your own children.
Sure. So after a number of years, Lori Tharps, have you perfected a response to people who feel that they are, you know, they're allowed to ask you these questions?
You know, I haven't. I really haven't. What I have perfected, though, is my personal, my internal response. I used to take it personally. It used to hurt me a lot more. And now, especially after writing this book and understanding that this happens to all people who don't fit this idea that family should match, I really now recognize that it is normal to notice difference. And for people to notice it is normal. For people to comment on it is even normal. If their comments are rude or intrusive, then, you know, I have perfected some, you know, responses. But I have to say that because my children are older now, people don't comment so much. When people have babies and young children, I think people feel more like okay with simply saying things like, where did you get that baby from? Right? Whose baby is that?
It's not too subtle.
Right. But because I guess the same reason why people think they can touch a pregnant woman's belly, right? Like there's something about babies that you can, you know, ask these questions. There's like an open season for being intrusive. But nobody comes up to me now and says, you know, whose baby is that with my daughter who's now 5? But they still will say, whose child is that? Or we were at a restaurant recently and my husband was holding my daughter and the hostess wanted to seat me and my boys. And then she looked at my husband and my daughter and said, and how many are in your party, sir? Well, there's still the disconnect. And then, in that situation, I say, oh, we're all together.
Right.
But it still happens that there is a public not understanding that we are actually a family.
Let me get the number out, 888-477-9499. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We're talking about colorism this hour with author Lori Tharps, who has written the book Same Family, Different Colors. And Lori, so when it comes to something like this, I mean, you're the adult, you're absorbing these comments, but your children have ears, so... How do you deal with this with your children?
Well,
what do you say to them?
You know, it's interesting. That's why I wrote this book, because I really wanted to make sure that all of these preoccupations with difference in color and how, you know, one child would be perceived as of color, either African American or, you know, maybe Latino, which has happened to him, my eldest son, whereas my middle son could very easily pass for something else. It really became important for me to understand what is the right way. I can't look to my parenting because my siblings we're all the same color. Both my parents were African American, although my mom is a little bit darker than my father, but there was never a conversation about skin color differences. So everything I have to do as a parent in terms of raising three children who are three different colors is new. And so I wanted to write this book to see how other people did it. And really, it's kind of the reason I write all my books is because I have a question and I want to answer it. And so I went to African-American, Latino, Asian-American, and other interracial families and basically asked that question is, you know, what happens when people are different colors? How does that affect parenting? How does it affect sibling relationships? And I talked to some experts too. And one psychologist said very easily that the thing that you have to do as a parent who happens to be raising children who are different colors is really normalize difference. We have a long history of trying to make everybody the same.
Yeah.
And everybody isn't the same. And children, as young as two, recognize this mommy's darker than daddy. Sibling is darker or lighter than sibling. And we have to be okay with that instead of trying to make it all the same and saying, yeah, maybe mommy is the color of chocolate and daddy's the color of butterscotch. They're both delicious. Right?
Yeah.
And let's go with that.
But there are some very difficult conversations as well. I mean, mm-hmm. You write that you have to have different conversations with your two sons because one looks black and one might look white. And mm-hmm. There are very different issues that these kids might have to confront as they grow up and go out into the world.
Absolutely.
So tell us more about that.
Yeah. So that was one of the when I started writing the book, Trayvon Martin trial was actually just beginning. And it really hit home at this point that we weren't just talking about, you know, who's got prettier, you know, which hair product should we use? Or, you know, someone has to wear more sunscreen lotion than the other, which are issues that we're talking about. But when it comes down to it, the way my elder son is perceived in the world is different than the way my middle son is perceived in the world. And the decision I had to make, or the one I thought I had to make was, you know, do I have the talk with my elder son about how he should behave in public, considering that there seems to be open season on black men in this country? And if I have that conversation with him, do I have that conversation with my younger son, who may not be perceived as a black male threat? That really, I struggled with that because I felt, how could I introduce that concept that one child has a privilege that the other one doesn't simply because of the color of his skin.
And so what did you decide?
So my decision, and again, it's really helped writing the book, you know, talking to so many other people, but eventually I decided not to have the talk, but what I would deem a talk. I had the same conversation with both children, and that came from the idea that my children are both black and Spanish, and that who they are isn't determined by the color of their skin. Who they are is determined by, you know, who their parents are. You know, they have a black parent and they have a Spanish parent, and the world, they are black males in the eyes of this country. And so I teach them to conduct themselves in a way that brings pride to who they are, regardless of their skin color.
We're looking at colorism this hour of Radio Times. Lori Tharps is our guest. She is the author of the new book, Same Family, Different Colors. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be talking some more in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. And our guest this hour is Lori Tharps. She is an associate professor of journalism at Temple University. And her book is called Same Family, Different Colors. And it explores the perceptions that a person's skin color can engender within this country and in other communities across the world, as a matter of fact. If you'd like to give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. And we were talking, Lori, about some, you know, personal anecdotes within your own family. Mm-hmm. And during the break, you're pointing out that, you know, even though there are perceived societal advantages for people who have lighter skin, it's not all a walk in the park necessarily for kids who are in communities of color who happen to be very light sometimes.
Yes, right. I mean, one of the reasons, I should say the main reason that I wanted to write this book was to really start a conversation about skin color politics. As you mentioned in your intro, people don't talk about colorism kind of out in the open. It's still this kind of taboo topic that we keep at home behind closed doors.
You write that talking about color is hard.
Yes, it really is. And it was even surprising to me because color is so obvious. Like, it's not something you can hide. Race, you can theoretically hide. This idea of passing and all these different ways. Just sometimes you're just ambiguous in your racial category because racial categories are invented and they don't make real sense when you try to apply them across the board. But color is, you know, it's there for everybody to see. And yet and still, you know, acknowledging, you know, where on the rainbow you fall, you know, darker, lighter. And of course, that's all subjective anyway. So my darker is your lighter or medium and things like that. It's challenging. And it is challenging because we don't really have a language to start the conversation with. Colorism, as you mentioned, isn't even officially a word. But also words like darker or dark skin or light skin are already loaded with significance. And many people assume that, you know, a light skin is the desire for all people. And globally, we can, you know, acknowledge that there is a hierarchy where light skin privilege exists. That being said, you know, my book really talks about, you know, skin color and colorism and skin color politics within the family unit, the nuclear family unit. And in talking to people across the color spectrum, there are many people who felt that, you know, being lighter in their family was, I wouldn't say it was a disadvantage, but it was a negative experience.
How so?
Because they felt isolated. They were singled out negatively because by their family in some cases, by their community in some cases, as not being, you know, really part of the community. They were too light to be a real Mexican. You were too light to be really black. You were too light to be Bangladeshi enough. I spoke to a young Bangladeshi woman who was often mistaken for Latina, and it really, really hurt her because she was never included in the community. To this day, she says she darkens her Instagram photos because she wants to be seen as part of her community. So one of the people I interviewed, Asha Bandale, who is a well-known activist, she termed this light skin isolation. And I think that was a fitting description for what many, many people feel. And you'll often see people who are the lightest in their community being the most active in their community or being the most, like, outwardly, whatever, you know, fill an ethnic group there because they want to make sure people understand I belong to this community. And at the end of the day, I think more than wanting a certain skin color, people want to belong. They want to belong to somebody, to some group, to some organization, to some community, and they want it to be recognized without having to wear a T-shirt. Right.
Well, let's talk about some of the very real effects that skin tone can have on a person.
Yes.
You know, economics.
Yes.
Lighter skin can mean an advantage. You tell of economist Joni Hirsch. She says in the New York Times, on average, being one shade lighter has about the same effect as having an additional year of education.
It's that study that she did was particularly on immigrants across cultures, immigrants in the United States, you know, keeping in mind, you know, education level, ability to speak English, all of that really paled, no pun intended, in comparison to whether or not the immigrants had lighter skin or not. And it was proven that lighter skin meant better access, better money, better resources. And this has been proven across ethnic groups in the United States, yeah, too. Light-skinned blacks tend to do better economically, have better access to education and resources.
Well, yeah,
and
even within black institutions of higher education, you found.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it is universally, there is an institutionalized colorism in this country. And it's not just from the quote-unquote founding fathers that institutionalized white supremacy, but also when you bring in all of the different immigrant groups that make up the United States population, where colorism is a big issue in East Asia, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, all of these communities bring their own brand of colorism to the United States as well. So we are still living in a pigmentocracy, if you will, when it comes to privileging those with light skin over dark skin. And those are very real facts. They've been proven by any number of sociologists and economists, to prove that there is, this is not a simple beauty issue or a self-acceptance and love issue, and that if we all just loved all the colors of the rainbow, these are really hard facts that are influenced by skin color.
Yeah, and you talk about, we're going to get to the calls in just a moment because we've got a lot of them, but in your book, you tell a number of stories where within families, it seems primarily, mothers and grandmothers and aunts, but sometimes dads too, treat their children differently depending on the skin tone.
Exactly. And that's, I wanted to make colorism accessible to people who may not have ever really thought about this issue, which is a lot of people. And that's why I talked about it within the family unit, because the family is just a microcosm of the greater society. And you can see that even in the household, there may be preferential treatment for light, but also there's preferential treatment for dark too, depending. I mean, you
and
just
never
know.
How does
that
work
know.
Generally? Is it trying to bolster the darker child's self-esteem?
In some cases, it really is. It's that. It's, family knows that the darker child will have a harder time in society, and so they privilege the darker child, or they give them that darker child extra support, extra love, because they're trying to make sure that their self-confidence is strong. And that, theoretically sounds like a good plan, except if you have a lighter child in the house, then that lighter child feels slighted, and they sometimes can, hate themselves or hate their own self, their own skin color, because they assume then that that darker child is more worthwhile. It's very difficult when you do have multicolors in the same family, because it's hard to know, which child do you, build up, because they're going to have the harder time in society. But I have to say that not every story in this book shows that there is colorism in a family of different colors.
Sure.
It was nice to see that there were some families that were able to say, I recognize that these children are different colors, and I'm going to make sure that I celebrate their differences, as opposed to trying to put a hierarchy within my own, household.
You tackle some very tough issues, though, in this book. You get into some really, it's hard to read now, not only among the African-American community, but Latino cultures and Asian cultures as well.
Mm-hmm.
Within the African-American community, you have a whole page about just phrases that are used that are negative. And even some of the things, you tell the story of Lauren, whose mom was a fair-skinned African-American and whose dad was a dark-skinned man. One of Lauren's aunts would offer up chestnuts like, I know they say the darker the berry, the sweeter the juice, but don't get diabetes, if she were looking to date a darker skinned man. So you tackle that.
Mm-hmm.
You tackle, hair stories, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You go there for what purpose?
I really want people to understand that colorism is not endemic to the African-American community.
Yeah.
A lot of people assume colorism is a black thing, meaning black American thing, and it is so not. It is so prevalent in the Latino community. It is so prevalent in the Asian community. And my hope is that if we stop siloing our conversations about color to our own communities, and again, in very quiet spaces, that we recognize that these are issues that we are all grappling with, then we might be able to, come together and build or come together and come up with solutions for dismantling colorism. The more we think that this is our own private problem, the less likely we are to be open about it and to share. If we understand that the stories in this book, for example, you could, cross out if you could just X out if this who you were talking about is an Asian person or a Latino person or a black person, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the pain and the agony that people were feeling. Like you said, mothers, aunties, grandmas, oftentimes the females telling the females what they
this is the ideal
this
of
is
beauty.
The ideal of beauty.
Right.
This is who you can and cannot associate with. These are the sad feelings I felt of isolation because I was too light. The stories are so common. And again, I believe that if we recognize that we have this commonality, we might be able to really start talking about solutions across the board and across cultures. And really, this idea of global colorism, it needs to be dismantled, and it needs to be dismantled from the community level.
Yeah. All right. We're going to talk about in just a couple moments bleaching, which covers Asian, Latino, African-American cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But first, we've got to get to some of these calls.
Sure.
Bruce in New Jersey, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. How you doing?
Well, thank you.
Yeah. This is an interesting topic. Personally, I went through it. 4 children. My wife at the time, she was mixed because her parents was mixed. And right off the top, I had to deal with people treating all of them differently because it was different skin tones, to dark to light, different hair tones and everything. Mm-hmm. And people would make crazy comments. I mean, comments about the younger, the lighter ones, they're good, and look at the other ones like they didn't belong. Hmm. And I found myself a lot of times taking up and wanting to actually isolate them from people, or either upset enough where I had to shield them or want to hurt a few people. And I mean, just be honest about it. And then I realized that I couldn't take it personal. So I had to talk with them to cause them to understand what the reality of what beauty is, not perceived beauty, goodness is, not perceived goodness. You know, you have to talk real to your children and be open and honest with them so they can see the world for what it is.
Bruce, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate your story on Radio Times. And I'm kind of moving along because we do have a lot of calls. But Lori,
yes, that,
your thoughts.
Bruce, that, you know, everything you just said was exactly what all the experts I spoke to for this book, that really being real with your children. Do not shield them from an idea of this panaceic color blindness. That is not the way to go. It is to tell your children from the beginning that, you know, people come in different colors, that there are people who are going to appreciate light over dark, and that's silly. Make your children understand that if they confront people who are suggesting that one is better than the other, make them look at, you know, the flowers in a garden, and is this red flower any better than the yellow flower? No, they're just different colors. And so it's very, very important for parents to do just what Bruce was saying, is to show your children, to be real with your children, to be honest with your children, and to celebrate all of their qualities and not highlight their color of their skin or the texture of their hair.
And some comments. We have a tweet from Mark. First and foremost, it's no one's business except yours and your husband's. A comment from Laura. I'm a white mother with a black daughter. Since she was young, her skin has always been much darker than mine. I never thought it was an issue until she and the father were separated and she had to get her two-year-old daughter a passport to go to Bermuda. His name was not on the birth certificate and she was barraged with questions on whether or not my daughter was actually mine. So... Mm-hmm. You're nodding your head, Lori.
Yes, I mean, I never had something as significant as, you know, being questioned by the government. But I did have an experience where a woman at a Mommy and Me class really wanted me to go get a DNA test because she would not believe that my son really belonged to me. She was convinced that they had mixed him up at the hospital. She told me all kinds of stories about accidental baby mix-ups. And I literally stopped going to the class because she was so, you know, intent on, she just could not believe that my child belonged to me. That I claimed him, but she still was like, that's impossible. He's too light. That could not be your child.
Yeah. That's got to really have a wearing and exhausting effect on you.
It does. And I'm glad I'm a writer because I would often take these experiences and put them in my blog or, you know, share them in my writing in some way, which was really helpful because then I would hear from other people who had had similar, you know, like the caller. She couldn't get up or the last post, you know, having a passport, you know, denied or questioned. So, again, I know I'm not alone with this, and that gives me comfort.
Yeah. Well, Lori Tharp, so let's talk about bleaching your skin. Mm-hmm. It's a practice that, you know, Latino cultures, Asian cultures, African-American cultures, it sounds, you know, painful and even dangerous. Mm-hmm. And what do you know of the effects of this practice? Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting. The New York Times did a story yesterday, and the Sunday Times had a big cover story in the style section about bleaching in Africa, in West Africa particularly. And It's really the bleaching or skin whitening. There's so many euphemisms: skin brightening, skin lightening, skin whitening, and bleaching. Like they're all on the spectrum of changing your skin color from dark to light, and that the bleaching cream industry is poised to grow by
really?
Something like 10% before 2020, and the largest component of growth is actually the male consumer. The idea that this industry is growing and they want to continue to grow is a big impact on why light skin privilege still exists and is so strong across the world, because you do have this industry that's continuously telling people, you know, your life would be a lot better if you had lighter skin, if you had a lighter complexion on your face, if your whole body was lighter. I mean, to the point where you have genital bleaching products because your
really?
Whole body must be light. And this is obviously going into the historic belief system of, you colonization, yeah. white supremacy, you know, all the different ways that history has pushed out a white supremacist mindset. But then when you have this kind of, you know, power structure where light and white are in power, and then you have an industry that's saying, I can make you white and light with our little products here. It's very hard. The pushback would have to be astronomical to not buy into this idea that if I could just get light from a bottle, from a product, I would do it. And you have famous people, you have celebrities, you have sports stars, Sammy Sosa's, you know, comes to mind. You have Lil Kim, the 90s rapper who is now like seven shades lighter than she was in the 90s. You see people doing it and you actually think maybe that is the answer because you, like I said in my book, there are so many statistics that say light skin has an advantage. We have people, there was a Latino immigrants populations in certain states where new immigrants were bleaching their babies and their pregnant bellies because they wanted their children to have an advantage in this country.
Well, let me ask you quickly before we get to the break. You know, Madison Avenue obviously doesn't help quite often in representing mm-hmm. dark-skinned African Americans or other folks of color. But, you know, Lupita Nyong'o, who recently won an Academy Award mm-hmm. and is celebrated as a great beauty. Her skin tone is dark brown. Mm-hmm. You know, her face has been splashed across magazine covers.
Yes.
Do you see the narrative beginning to change a little bit?
No. I'm going to be honest.
Okay.
No. But what I see is the same thing that I saw in the natural hair community, and that's my, you know, I've been a hair historian for a long time, and we saw the natural hair movement follow the same path. And this is what I see with color. Because we have the internet and everybody has access to creating their own visual narrative now, I do see that in individual spaces, in individual communities, individuals themselves putting up visions of beauty that are not light, right? Mainstream media, yes, Lupita is on the cover of Vogue, wonderful, but she's like one. She's not like, this is not happening across the board. But I see that we can put up our images, we can give alternate images, we can create our own books, our own movies, TV shows, and we can bring up a new image of dark beauty.
All right. Lori Tharps is our guest. Her book is Same Family, Different Colors. And I promise we're going to get to those phones as soon as we're out of the break. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Lori Tharps has written Same Family, Different Colors. And we're talking about the concept of colorism, which is a word that you won't even find officially defined in the dictionary. And yes, Lori, as you write in your book, it auto-corrects when you're at the computer. I found that myself. But yet it is a very real and very difficult issue to talk about within a number of communities.
Yes.
So we have a lot of calls to get to. So Gabrielle in Philadelphia, you are next, and welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. For Lori, in my own personal experience, if I could talk for a little second. I'm a biracial woman. I'm 22-year-old college student, and I never experienced colorism. My mom is African-American of medium brown. My father is, I would say, light. He's Caucasian, but he's more of like on the pinker side, not like melanin, like if he's Italian. Mm-hmm. So my dad burns. My mom is medium brown. Me and my sister came out extremely like light high yellow. So we're the same tone. But our difference is we have colorism, and then we have like discrimination on our features. She's more fuller built. I'm not. I have a Caucasian, large, like Slavic, Germanic nose, and she has my mother's nose. My curls are very long, and they kind of look like Italian, thick Italian hair. My sister's hair is like high shrinkage, tight coily.
Hey, Gabrielle, let me just jump in for a second, since we have an iffy line. What are the differences that you and your sister have experienced in the outside world, reaction from the outside world, if any?
We have a difference in dating. A lot of like African American men pursue her more because of her figure. Maybe they a lot of times they find her facial features more relatable. When I get pursued a lot more by white males, boyfriend is white, her boyfriend is African. I've been told by white guys, oh, you don't look white. You don't look black. You look more white. So that's why I seek you out. When my sister,
right. You know what? I am going to have to – we'll have to jump in just because the line is not the greatest, but you're nodding your head, Lori. This is, you know, probably nothing you haven't heard before in your research.
Yes. I mean, it's really interesting. You know, this is, again, why I thought talking to families would be a really, really instructive way to share with the public how much skin color can define somebody's life experiences. And when you hear two sisters, you know, same parents, same household, and yet their life experience is going to be so different. One is going to be perceived as African-American. The other one is going to be perceived as white or Italian or Slavic, as she said. And sometimes these differences are, you know, not as extreme, you know, maybe like she said, you know, maybe dating differences, but they can also be as extreme as Michael Eric Dyson, the well-known professor at Georgetown and author and speaker, who is a, you know, an Ivy League professor, and his brother, who is darker skinned, is in prison. And it really can be very stark how not necessarily the parents treat their children, but the outside world treats, you know, people who look different, obviously. And when it's in the same family, those different experiences really are stark because, you know, again, everything else is the same about these two people. They just have different skin tones. And
so how do you affect change?
How do you affect change? Well, I think change, I really think change comes when in the family, and it can start in the family, can start on the personal level, where we all begin to recognize that skin color differences are really nothing more than biology. There's nothing that is intrinsic to the skin color that is connected to somebody's worth. They're not smarter. They're not prettier. They're not better. They're not worse. That skin color is truly simply biology. It's simply an evolutionary adaptation to the sun. You know, how close you are living to the sun. So that's first, is education, first and foremost. We have to educate ourselves as to what skin color really actually means. And if we can begin there, then we can hopefully begin to appreciate beauty in all its different shades. And that comes literally from a concerted effort to see more images of different shades of people as, you know, put up as beautiful. And that, like you said, on billboards, in magazines, in movies, in television, on Pinterest pages, you know, using whatever media sources that we have to really amplify the vision of beauty. Right now, across the world, beauty still comes in kind of light, bright, and almost white. Even in countries where the majority of people are dark-skinned, they still have beauty images of much lighter beauty. And it just, it's impossible to, you know, even with self-awareness, even with education, if everything that's held up as beautiful is light, you're not going to be able to teach people that. But again, like I said, you really have the ability to create. We, because of the internet and because of the technology now, we can print our own books. We can create our own web series. You know, we can make movies with an iPhone.
Sure.
And really produce dark beauty or shades of difference in and get this visual image into the minds of the next generation. And even, you know, the people who are already here, we don't have to wait for the next generation to save us. We all can be doing that work. And we all have to admit that we have a bias. All of us have a bias because of the world we live in to appreciate lighter beauty than darker beauty.
All right. To Callie now in Germantown. Callie, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Hi. My daughter is 6 years old, and her dad's Korean, and I'm white. And she sees herself as white when she talks about her own race because her skin is really pale. And she doesn't reject her Koreanness, but she thinks of it as just culture and language and not race. And so I struggle how to talk to her about actually being mixed race. And, you know, I want her to embrace her ancestry as a race, not just as a culture and language. And I'm wondering, what do I do? How do I talk about that?
Thanks, Callie, for the call.
Larry. You know, that's a really great question, and it's really interesting to look at Asian culture because a lot of people, including people I interviewed for this book, you know, particularly from East Asia, they said, we don't have colorism issues. We're all the same color. You know, there's not really an issue. Well, of course.
But you found differently.
Of course. There are shades of difference even in Asian countries. there's this kind of appreciation for whiteness. So this is definitely a conversation that is very, very prevalent in many Asian cultures, to talk about lightness and lightness being the prize. I think for a parent, like the caller, you know, Asian Korean isn't really, I mean, Korean is a culture. It isn't really a race. So I think to continue to celebrate her culture as, you know, Korean is fine. I don't think a mother has to define or make the child, you know, make sure she understands that she's not white. I think that if she wants to consider herself, finding a label that works for both. I think Korean American is perfect because she's Korean and American.
Sure.
I don't think you need to focus for a child, because a child only sees color. So they are going to see that her skin is white like mommy's, and daddy's is probably very close to white also. So she is simply looking at the color of her skin and defining that. But in terms of identity, you talk about your ancestors having Korean identity, and you talk about mommy's, you know, American, whatever her background is, and you share the fullness of her ethnic heritage. And so when identity really matters, when she's really, you know, 10, 12, 14, and somebody says, what are you? What's your background? What's your heritage?
And you think they will.
She'll say Korean, because white is, she's just commenting. Like, that's all, that's the only, that brain development of a six-year-old is to see their color, and that's what it is.
Sure. In your book, you delve into quite a bit of history, and mm-hmm. you do talk about Asian history as mm-hmm. well as Latino history and African-American history. You know, you write that contrary to what many might assume in both East and South Asia, the adoration, as you put it, of light skin predates any contact with white Europeans. But it was really a matter of economics.
Exactly, exactly.
When Tell us about that.
Yes, it's really, when we talk about color, skin color politics in Asian cultures, both in East Asia and in South Asia, although some, you know, when India is a different story because it was colonized by the British. But even there, the idea of why light skin is prized over darker skin really goes back to an class system, where those who had enough money and privilege to stay indoors and not have to work in the sun, these were the lighter skinned people, whereas those who had to toil in the sun had darker skin and therefore were considered the peasant class. And it wasn't just class. There became an association with any peasant was also less educated, poor, uncivilized, barbarian. So that even today in China, in Japan, in Korea, that you have this idea that lighter skin somehow indicates that you are educated, you are civilized, you are beautiful. And if you have darker skin, you are associated with still all of those negative attributes. And so you have mothers telling their daughters, you don't want to be with someone darker because that person is going to be associated with. You don't want to get your skin dark. Don't get in the sun because you will been looked. You will be looked at as low class. And also for women, particularly darker women who were considered having to work outside, they were also considered to maybe be loose and wanton because they were out of the home and away from the protection of, you know, their family members. So there's so much baked into the concept of lightness in Asian society. It's very much beauty, but it has a lot more connotations to what that means. And it might often just says, oh, I don't want to be dark because I don't want to be thought of as a peasant.
Yeah. All right. Continuing with the calls, staying in Philadelphia, Nancy, let's go to you. Welcome to Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay, while I agree with most of what your author is saying, I just wanted to say that my personal experience, and it is fairly long, I lived and raised a kid in a Latin American country, I won't say which, but I have a real firm belief that speaking at least of Central America and Mexico, skin color is prejudice, plain and simple. It's racism, plain and simple. There's no other way to call it.
Nancy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You do address Mexico. Mm-hmm. And you also talk about two separate things here, racism and colorism. They're linked, but they're not exactly one and the same.
Right. Absolutely. My take on this is that you don't really know somebody's race until you see it on a check mark on a box, but you know what somebody's color is just by looking at them. And so a lot of times the experience that people have is, you know, prejudice based on their skin color. We saw a man, an Indian man in the South, be beaten because he was thought to be an African American. People didn't ask, excuse me, sir, where are you from before I beat you up? It was, I see a dark skinned man and I am, you know, offended by dark skin. I mean, I'm going to make assumptions on your darkness. And so colorism, I mean, the prejudice against people based on their skin color is really based on visual appearance. Racism obviously is based on, you know, a person's race. And there are, my opinion is that as we continue to become a browner and more culturally and ethnically ambiguous nation, that our conversations about racism are going to have to expand to include colorism. Because
do you see this happening?
I think it's going to happen. I mean, it has to happen because we are having situations where, you know, you're having people, you're having black people who look white receive the privileges of the white class, right? And you have people who are not necessarily African American being discriminated against because of their dark skin. The first case of colorism that went to the courts was actually two Latino people. And initially the judge threw it out because he said, you can't have two people of the same race, you know, accusing them of racism if they're both Latino, right? Or they're both Puerto Rican. And it was the plaintiff was saying, I'm being discriminated against in my job because I'm darker and my Latino boss is being dismissive, being racist towards me, and isn't giving me the promotion I should have gotten. And it wasn't until the EEOC got involved and they said, you can have this thing like intra-racial colorism. And these conversations, this expansion of our discussion of prejudice is really going to have to expand because people are being judged by the way they look and not necessarily because of, you know, what their ancestry is, their one drop of black blood, so to speak.
Yeah. All right, I'd like to get a couple of more comments in before we wrap up the hour. Ron says, I'm African American. My wife is white. Each of our four children looks different. Skin tone, hair texture, facial features. They've been mistaken for Latino, Asian, and etc. Being in a multicultural church, community, and family has been helpful when talking about colorism.
Absolutely. I think that for those of us, I live in Mount Airy, and I think that being surrounded by families that look very similar to mine has been a nice bubble to raise my children in. Of course, when they go out in the world, this is when we have to have those bigger discussions and prepare them for the world beyond Mount Airy.
Sure. And Kelly tweets, just want to add that skin color isn't the only thing that's prized. There's a deep cultural preference for blue eyes, straight hair, and et cetera.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of times, like particularly when I talk to people in the Asian American community, when I said colorism, it was like, you know, crickets. Nobody wanted to talk about it. But when we talk about wanting rounder eyes, having eye surgery, thinner noses, lighter skin, it's more than just the color of the skin when we talk about colorism or white skin privilege. It's really this whole kind of European beauty aesthetic based on white beauty.
So we started off the program talking about your kids. They were little, I guess, you know, when we were talking about incidents that you'd experienced. So today, how are they doing?
My kids are great, and they've actually taught me a lot.
Lori?
So when I asked them, you know, because one of the things in learning about this book was, you know, open up the conversation, don't hide. Some of my fears as a parent, I brought to them, and I said, what do you think when people call you guys, you know, different and think one's black, one's white? And they said, you know, Mom, a lot of people think we're twins. And it was like, oh, so maybe we are. Maybe there is a little bit of progress if my two children can be looked at and thought of as twins. And I think the continuous open conversation is what happens. And as they're older, they can have a conversation. They teach me things. I teach them things.
Well, Lori Tharps, thank you so much. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Lori Tharps is an associate professor of journalism at Temple University and author of Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. Remember, visit our Facebook page when you get the chance, and you'll also find our podcast there as well at whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you along for Radio Times.